Good afternoon. This is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Today, we have a very special guest in our studio with us. He's the man who brings you the intelligent chatter of ravens, the size of humpbacks, or the vocal arguments between grizzly bears. So please welcome Richard Nelson, host of Encounters. Hi, Richard.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you, Kathleen.
It's great to have you. And I want to let our listeners know we're going to archive this program so they can check back and listen to it in the future. We'd like them to participate in the conversation with us, so I want to throw out a few phone numbers for them. I know there's people who want to ask you some questions. If you'd like to talk to Richard today or pose a question or ask about an animal in Alaska, call us at 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752, or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. We do have some emails. We do have some people who are already trying to talk to us. But I wanted to sort of get one question right off the bat, because it's one I think you're asked all the time. Are you really out there?
Well, that depends what you mean by that.
You are out there.
A lot of people think I'm definitely really out there.
I mean, when you create an Encounters episode,
yeah.
Are you really out there?
Oh, absolutely. I am such a stickler for nonfiction. If I had to record Encounters programs in a studio, I wouldn't be doing Encounters programs.
This is just an excuse to get out there.
Absolutely. I mean, I am a fanatical lover of the outdoors, and recording these radio programs is a great way to spend lots of time outdoors. So absolutely, the programs are recorded wherever I say they are. And if I'm talking about an animal or something like that being around, it's there.
Okay. Well, that's very satisfying to know for us listeners. I'd love to know, you listen to so many sounds, and you've done this since 2004. Is there a sound that thrills you, chills you, sends the hair standing up on the back of your neck, or do they all do that for you?
Well, all of the sounds do thrill me. I mean, if it's a little tiny singing vole or if it's a brown bear, I just get excited about all of them, a warbler to a bald eagle, whatever. But there are some sounds that I think just have a lot of power, and those are probably my favorites. One that comes to mind for sure is to be really, really close to whales, which you can do if you're with a whale researcher. Otherwise, it wouldn't be legal.
Right.
But I like to record those kinds of sounds so close that it just blows your ears out in the headphones. Mm. And then, you know, other exciting sounds like bears having big arguments between each other or things like that. But to be out in June and recording a thrush singing or something like that, that's right in there with the others to me. Mm. I love the beauty of sounds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
you're not
all
a musician, right? You have a highly developed sense of sound, but it's all the natural world.
Well, I mean, I guess it's the music that I love the most is the music that comes to us from the world. I am a music player. I like percussion, drums and didgeridoo and stuff like that.
Oh, that's right. I did remember that. Yeah.
That's an Australian Aboriginal instrument that I love to play. But yeah, my first love is the songs that are around us when we step out the door.
The music in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I promised our listeners they could ask questions, so I want to go ahead and put them on.
Well, let's do that.
All right. Doug, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Yeah. Yes, I'm here.
Do you have
can
a question?
Hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Yeah. Richard, this is Doug Pope. How are you?
Oh, hi, Doug.
Hey, listen, Joel Bennett used to have Hayden Caden went along with him on all his filming trips, which I always said was one of the best jobs in Alaska. So my question for you is, when you're out there in the field, it sounds like you're doing everything, but there's got to be somebody running the boat sometimes, or you know, somebody holding some sound equipment. But is it really just all you, or is there somebody out there helping you?
Yeah, that's a great question, Doug. It's just me. Sometimes I'm lucky enough to be out somewhere with a good friend, you know, camping on these trips or traveling together. that's always a great part of it for me. But when it comes time to go out and record radio programs, I insist on doing that myself. I like to be alone so that there's no distraction and I can completely focus on whatever the subject is and there's less commotion. Just one person makes a lot less fuss for an animal than two or more. The recording equipment is small, it's light, it's easy to carry, and it works beautifully that way. So I really don't need a big crew. It's one of the things I love about doing radio as opposed to film or television. Don't need a crew, don't need heavy stuff, just out there having a great time.
Could I follow up, Kathleen?
Yes, you can, Doug.
So, Richard, the other part is you're so clearly a good writer, and I'm just wondering, you know, it sounds like you're just doing it on extemporaneously out in the field, but I because I know a little bit about writing, it strikes me that you must have written some of this stuff ahead of time. If you're out there by yourself, you know, essentially recording and talking at the same time, could you address that?
Yeah, sure. Another good question. I do a lot of research before I go out to record a program. I have lots of notes. It's a combination of following those notes and saying whatever comes to mind. When I record a program, I usually record, I flip on the recorder and record straight through, usually for about an hour, and then I turn the recorder off and then cut it down to about half that in the studio. So it's a combination of just extemporaneous and these notes that I write beforehand.
Thank you very much. I'm real impressed.
Thanks for calling, Doug. It's nice to hear from you.
Justin, we've got a call from Justin.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Hello, Justin.
Hi. I wanted to ask about, in listening to your program and also in reading your work, there's this wonderful mixture of spiritual elements and personal, you know, essayistic type elements and writing with very hard scientific data, facts. And I just wondered if you could comment on your view of the relationship between hard science and more spiritual elements in your life and work.
Wow, that's a really good question, Justin. We could probably spend the rest of the hour on it. It's such a big and beautiful thought. I have been very influenced in my own sort of ideas about spirituality by the teachings of Koyukon, Athabascan Indian people who I lived with up in the interior. I mean, I grew up in obviously a sort of regular standard Christian kind of an environment. Never thought of myself being extremely spiritual or something like that. I don't follow any particular path in that regard, but I believe very strongly in the wisdom of approaching the natural world as a place of power and spirit and a place that we should, toward which we should behave with humility and respect. And that, to me, mixes beautifully with science and with the spiritual traditions, because I think science is uncovering a part of reality, but only a part. And it's also a beautiful part. I think the lesson that science could afford to learn is to pay more attention to the soul and spirit and to the heart. And I think the most brilliant scientists who I have ever been privileged to hear or read are the ones that do engage their heart along with their intellect. I feel like I'm dancing around it, but it's a complicated issue. For me personally, I think I lead first with my emotions. But part of that emotion is that I love knowing the facts of the world, and then trying to blend those together, and then to acknowledge the possibility that there's something much greater behind it all, just makes it all the more beautiful.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for that question. That was great, Justin.
Bye.
Bye.
I wanted to get to a question we had from the email. Annie called to ask whether Richard whether there's any conservation and natural protection organizations that you believe make exceptional use of charitable contributions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that's very interesting. I've been involved with conservation for a long time, and I'll say a couple of things. That's how I use my permanent fund check every year, to support conservation. It makes me feel like a philanthropist. And I just love the idea of people using that little check that comes in the mail to support whatever it is they happen to feel strongly about. You know, mine happens to be conservation, but diversity is the key to it. You know, I'll support conservation, you support human rights, or whatever it is that means the most to you. As far as my own way that I, where I put most of my support is locally. And that way I have a pretty good idea of what happens with the funding. So the largest part of my permanent fund check goes to local conservation, to an organization that I've been on the board of for the last 30 years or something like that. As far as how organizations use their funding, I can know that best if it's an organization that I'm involved with or can look at closely myself. On the other hand, the other thing I say about conservation, as I would about any other form of activism, is that diversity is really important. So I like the whole spectrum of conservation organizations, from ones that are maybe not very compromise-oriented to ones that are very compromised-oriented, because I think diversity is our strength, every kind of diversity. I love human diversity, intellectual diversity, spiritual diversity, all of it. And so that's my response to that really neat question.
That's great. I think we covered it. I heard you talk a little bit last night about salmon, and I loved this idea that salmon is actually this incredible food delivery system into all of Alaska, these fish coming up, spawning and dying and feeding everything along the way. I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that and maybe tell us what you've been doing with salmon lately.
Yeah, this has been the summer of salmon for me. I've been working on a couple of radio programs about salmon that'll be on the air hopefully sometime soon. And in the course of this summer, I have been paddling my kayak over to a salmon stream near my home in Sitka every day or most days through the whole salmon season. And it's just been an incredibly exciting experience. And during the course of it, just came to see more than ever what a miraculous creature the salmon are. I mean, taken collectively, what the biologists tell us is that the salmon, you know, they come from the stream, they go out into the ocean, they go way out into the big gyre of the North Pacific and into the Bering Sea, some into the Arctic Ocean. They grow, feed and grow out there. They come back as what you can say from an ecological standpoint are big packets of nutrients from the far reaches of the ocean. So they're bringing this incredible abundance of nutrients into the streams and rivers and trickles of Alaska. And as the salmon come in, of course, we all know the gulls and the eagles and the bears and the otters and the seals and the killer whales and all these animals are feasting on them. So it is this amazing delivery system. And we were talking earlier about science and spirituality and the heart. And that's the beautiful thing that I get out of science, is not just the fact that's so amazing, but also something that you also take it into your heart and you go down and you look at these salmon and you say, man, I am staring into the eyes of a million little miracles here every time I see these animals.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We're so lucky. That's the other thing I have to say about salmon, is we are incredibly fortunate in Alaska for everything that salmon bring to us and give to us. And what we need to do in exchange for that is to take care of the places where the salmon are born, their nest, where the young are born. We need to take care of our rivers. And if we do that, look at all the ways we benefit, from commercial fishing to the people who process the fish, to those of us who sit down and have them for dinner, the ones that we caught ourselves, to all the tourists who come here to look at them, to all the other animals that live around us, this great, burgeoning, brilliant, beautiful community of creatures
right.
that live around us. Yeah. That's a gift to us from salmon. And all we got to do to earn it is take care of the water that they need to be alive.
Mm. I know you said something last night about a genetic system that's taken millions of years so that they know exactly where to go, sometimes even exactly what part of the stream to go to. And it's just amazing. And it just happens every year, you know? It's amazing.
Exactly. Happens every year. We all get to look at it. And then you think of the fish that you're looking at in one creek are not the same as the ones you're looking at in the other creek. And so every little bit of water is unique. And the fish that are coming from 1,000 or 2,000 miles out there in the ocean are unique to that little piece of water.
It's blowing my mind just listening to you talk about it. It's amazing. It's really amazing. And, you know, it happens and you don't even really think about it. One of the things I thought about listening to you is it takes us out of the center picture. I mean, we are no longer the center if we become aware of really the amazing things going on around us.
Exactly. And you know, I think that's one of the great insights of many indigenous traditions around the world, to see yourself as a small part of a big thing and to see that this big thing is in charge. And we in Western culture have been entertaining the fantasy that maybe we're in charge and treating the world as if we can maneuver it and manipulate it in any way we want. And of course, the big world is giving us messages back that maybe that's not working out so well. And maybe we need to rein it in a little bit, just as elders in Native communities have been saying for a long time, that as I was mentioning often, that this elder Koyukon man told me, he said, just remember that the brown bear knows way more than you do. and I think at a bigger scale, we have to remember that the world is a way bigger thing than we are. And if we treat it that way, we're going to get along fine with it.
Mm-hmm. We won't assume too much. Right?
And we're starting to learn that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're seeing that and we're saying, okay, all right, we've gone a little bit too far with this and with that. And to just like climate change is a very big message to us to, okay, just cool it here, so to speak.
Yeah. Back off, bucko.
Yeah.
Let's see, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your growing up and whether that actually shaped your passion for this. I mean, you love to research. You told us that. But what really fired you up for this?
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin in a suburb of Madison, so a pretty darn standard way to grow up, and I'm grateful for it. I loved it there, and I still do. As a small kid, probably at about age 5, I started chasing butterflies around in the backyard. And, you know, I don't know where it comes from. My parents, you know, were not
scientists.
They weren't even outdoorsy people. They weren't scientists. They always encouraged my odd fascinations, which I've always been very grateful for that, is that they said, oh, this is what he's interested in. Let's help him to do this.
Nice.
You know, I thought that was a beautiful gift from a parent to see what their child wanted to be, and let's do this then together. So the love for nature started as early as I can remember. And then growing up in Wisconsin and going to the university there and taking classes, sort of natural history, biology type classes, I began to learn about how rich that place had been with buffalo and elk and all the great herding animals and the mountain lions and all the stuff that had been there that wasn't there anymore. And I just remember carrying around a lot of sadness about that. And there was a period of my life when it also included a lot of negativity and sort of hopelessness. Oh, this is all going to fall apart, so what are we doing? And as I became older, the passion has stayed there, but not a sort of hopelessness at all. My hope comes from pitching myself into the world, experiencing every bit of it that I possibly can, and being active on behalf of the things I care about. For me, that's two things. That's the wild world of Alaska and beyond, and doing what little I can to try to help keep it rich and diverse and productive, and indigenous traditions, which is the other part of my life. I've been fortunate enough to spend some years living with Native people in Alaska, and that's the linchpin of my life. And so my other work is to celebrate the achievements, the intellectual achievements and the spiritual achievements of Indigenous people, and try to pass those things along to others.
Well, that's great. Let's talk about that. I want to throw our phone numbers out there again.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
I think that if you've just joined us, we're talking with Richard Nelson, the host of Encounters, and a person who's maybe listened to every kind of animal in Alaska that you can listen to.
As many as I could find so far.
So if you've got questions for Richard, please call us at 550-8433 or outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's go back and talk a little bit about the living in rural communities. Were you a young graduate student when you first went out?
Yeah, I first came to Alaska when I was 19 years old as an assistant for an archaeological project. And then that was on Kodiak Island, then again to the Aleutians. And then when I was 23 years old, I had this extraordinary opportunity to go and live in the village of Wainwright up on the Arctic coast, next village down the coast from Barrow. And I spent the most amazing year with an extraordinary project funded by the United States Air Force to learn how to subsist and survive on the Arctic ice. And someone involved with the Air Force had the insight to realize that if you want to learn about that, you ought to go to the people who know it best, and that's the Inupiaq people.
Wow.
So that was the first time I'd ever lived away from home. I was a pretty young guy, and I often think about that at age 23, I was off to live in a village
by
myself for a year.
Did you have the right gear? Did you have the right, I mean, can you remember the day you landed? And
oh, yeah. Oh, yes. It's one of the most vivid memories of my life.
Tell me a little bit about it.
The plane took off from Barrow. I met the first really Indigenous people who I'd ever spoken with in Barrow. The plane flew down to Wainwright, landed on the beach. There was no airstrip there. There was no electricity. It was dog team days. And all my stuff was dumped out on the beach, including me, and the plane flew away in a big cloud of dust, and there I stood with a couple hundred people lined up on the bank
looking at you.
Yeah, and it was just the most amazing and beautiful thing that people took me in and were incredibly kind to me, found out what my interests were, and helped me in every way imaginable, and totally changed the direction of my life.
It sounds like it did,
yeah.
Really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go to some callers because we really want them to have the chance to talk
sure.
to you. So, Joanne, you're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you. I enjoy listening to your show. I'd like to ask a question about your technical equipment, where you buy it from, and in particular, how you pick up the sounds. Do you use like a cone-shaped receiver receiving antenna, or do you just use a microphone, and where you get such equipment?
Yeah, good questions, Joanne. Thanks for calling. Well, the recorder that I use is a pretty straightforward digital recorder. And, you know, it's a kind of recorder. I love this question because it's so neat to encourage people to do their own recording. You can get a little recorder for, I don't know what they cost, for an inexpensive $100 maybe for a recorder, get a microphone. And I use a parabolic dish, which is a sort of circular, scooped out round dish. Pretty simple thing, looks like a big salad bowl. And for the early years of recording Encounters programs, I did in fact use a salad bowl for my parabolic, and that was how I recorded the natural sounds. So it can be pretty simple, and you can get out there and record the beautiful sounds that you have around you all year. The recording equipment that I use now is more expensive. I suppose I'm carrying around maybe $5,000 worth of gear. But if you compare, you could buy a good single lens, reflex camera. You know, you could pay a couple thousand or $3,000 for that with a long lens on it. So the recording, even the best recording equipment, and I think what I have is way up there toward the best, is that relatively inexpensive. But you don't need that For a couple hundred bucks or less, you could outfit yourself with good recording equipment.
And where do you get it?
Well, I just order it online. There's lots of places. If you just start Googling around, go to Amazon and start checking out recording equipment, and you can easily enough find it. But if you need really some specific advice, depending on what you want to do, good question. There are lots of recording. Like if you're interested in natural sounds, there are a lot of websites. Just type in natural sounds recording. Google that, and you can get some advice. You know what I need to do, Joanne? You make me think. As I need to put together, like, I know we should do this for the website. For our Encounters website, a little toolkit. We can't do it like right away, though, but you've inspired me to think. I'll go back and we'll try to do this on the Encounters website. That's www.encountersnorth.org, and that's going to be linked up to the KSKA website.
Yes, you can find that right on KSKA, alaskapublic.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
And we're going to go right to Karen in Chugiak. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm so glad to hear you both on the radio and glad you're here, Richard.
Thank you.
I'm an amateur naturalist, and my current big interest is cottonwood trees. And I hope that you can say some good things about the importance of them to the ecology and maybe their traditional uses, because I just hate to see the war on cottonwood trees that so many people have engaged in around here.
Because they don't like the fuzz that blows off of them?
Yeah, they don't like that, and say they're allergic to them, and, they're messy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is such an interesting question. I'm not a very good botanist, and I won't be able to give an adequate answer to some of the parts of it. But, you know, I have a similar feeling about cottonwoods. I love cottonwood trees. When you drive up the highway, up the Haines Road from Haines, you're going up toward Haines Junction. Along that road are the most magnificent, huge cottonwood trees. Good grief, it's amazing. And I've often marveled at that. I grew up around cottonwood trees, and people would get grumpy about the fuzz blowing onto their screens and all that kind of stuff. And I never understood it, because I think cottonwoods are such a brilliant, beautiful thing. And they also, I think, put a beautiful smell into the air in the summer. Those things, how would you ever measure the value of those things in monetary terms? You can't. They're priceless. As far as people having allergies to them, what can I say? I remember being here in Anchorage a couple springs ago recording some stuff, and man, I had a miserable allergy from all, I guess it was the birch stuff in the air or something like that. But it never occurred to me that to really blame the trees for it. It's just part of the world, I guess, you know?
That's my thinking too. And I love that you mentioned the smell, because to me, that's the essence of springtime in Alaska.
Absolutely. You know, one of my first, well, I would say my very first memory of Alaska, period, was in 1961, coming down out of a propeller plane that we flew up from Seattle and landed on Kodiak. And the very first thing that hit me, so my absolutely, never thought about this, my very first memory of Alaska is the smell of cottonwood trees. And coming down there, I thought, man, is that ever a beautiful smell.
So there you heard it, an endorsement from Richard Nelson for cottonwoods.
All power to the cottonwood trees.
Glad I could jog that memory. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Karen. We're going to go to Barbara. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, Richard, I know that you've worked tediously on each of those scripts, you know, doing a lot of research, and I'm wondering sort of what your batting average is. When you go out into the field, do you have, like, one script with you, and you're going to find that bear no matter what, or you have to go four or five times to find a bear, or if you just go out in the field and you've got a whole bunch of different things going on with you?
Yeah.
You know, so that, oh, there's a bear. I'll pull out the bear script. And
yeah, that's a really good question. The programs aren't really scripted, but I do have these notes that I use. It depends on the trip. You know, sometimes I'll take along material for multiple programs. Sometimes I'll get out there and I've got just got some raw material along with me, and oh, there's a situation, and I'll kind of design a program while I'm out in the field somewhere. It all varies, but I've had an incredible good luck in getting the thing that I'm after. And the reason for that is it isn't really about luck. It's about a lot of help from people like Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologists, gathering a lot of information before I make a trip somewhere. And so I've been really lucky in getting them. Other programs like the killer whale program took me about 3 years. A program about albatrosses, I think it was about 5 years till I actually, I went on trips looking for them and didn't find them.
Huh. So, and another question is, do you ever go out and start recording and then things just go ridiculously wrong?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You know, sometimes I just shut off the recorder and say, all right, this isn't happening. Usually it's because I'm not happening. And, you know, I'm just stumbling around so much. I think, oh, come on, let's just give this one up and shut off the computer or shut off the recorder and start again. And, here's a good one that'll happen fairly often. You know, you're in a situation and there's an animal there and you start to record and then the animal leaves. Well, then there's nothing to do.
End of story.
End of story. There's nothing to do but shut it off and start again.
I was wondering along the Barbara's lines, do you, when you're out there in the field talking, are you talking to anybody? Are you thinking of someone when you're talking?
Sometimes I think about my brother. My brother lives in Los Angeles, and I think, well, okay, he's not an Alaskan, he's not a nature guy, but he's intelligent and he's interested. He's an electronics engineer. And so I will occasionally think of him, but that was in the earlier days. Now it's more like I just talk. And, you know, I'm just mainly just really thinking more about what is that animal doing or what's happening around me right now. That's really my focus.
Yeah.
But in the earlier times, just to get an idea of talking to a person. Yeah, mm-hmm. One person. And it was my brother.
That's interesting. Did we answer your questions, Barbara?
Yes, and I just want to add that I just immensely enjoy your program, and every time I get so much out of it. And I also really appreciate the perspective that you give us on the Native American thinking and spirituality of it all. It's just awesome. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for that, Barbara. And I will have to say that I cannot say often enough how deeply indebted I am for the teachings of the Koyukon and Gwich'in and Inupiaq elders and others who have been my teachers over the years. A person had better be very careful before they take a lot of credit for something they know, because almost all of it was given to you by someone else. And I think Encounters, the radio program, is, I hope, a respectful and accurate celebration of the many people who have taught me. Mm. And so be careful before, I wouldn't want to take credit for that. The credit goes to the other people.
There you go. All right, and we have more questions coming in, so we're just going to take them, okay, Richard?
Yeah, great.
Jonathan, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Okay, thanks much. Richard, great to talk to you. We met about 12 years ago at a writer's workshop that you did in Homer.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. My first question was, are you planning to do another of those any time in the foreseeable future?
Well, it's a really nice question, Jonathan. Thank you. I used to spend a lot of time on the road with writing in various contexts, and I really enjoyed teaching writing workshops or participating in them. These days, with my work focused on radio, I haven't been doing that for some years, and I wouldn't say that I won't do it in the future. I'm getting more interested again in writing just because I enjoy doing it, but I needed a long break from it, like 10 years. The reason I went to radio is because I got tired of sitting at a desk, and radio is a way to stay involved with the same work but do it outdoors. So I'm sorry to say, Jonathan, I don't have any plans for that in the immediate future, but could happen.
You might switch again.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
I had one other quick question.
Okay.
One time, many years ago, I caught just a few minutes of a PBS show on Make Prayers to the Raven, your one of your books,
mm-hmm.
which I read and, by the way, I absolutely loved.
Thank you.
And I wasn't able to find the next episode. I've never found it. I couldn't find it on the PBS website recently. Netflix.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea where one would find that?
I am so glad you asked about that, Jonathan. The series is called Make Prayers to the Raven, as you probably know. It was produced through KUAC, public television in Fairbanks. And I believe that it's still available through the University of Alaska Press at the University in Fairbanks, the University of Alaska Press. Now, I could be wrong. That's information is a year or so old. But I hope you could find it that way. And the other thing I would say to you and to anybody else who might be interested in that, and I love that series of programs. And again, it's no credit to me. It's a credit to the people in the villages of the Keokuk River that they're so wonderful and rich. And I hope that they're available in libraries for people to pick up and watch. But if you want to try to purchase them, I would try that first. University of Alaska Press.
Okay. That sounds super well. I wrote it down, and I will look for that.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. We're going to go right to
your work. Keep it up.
Thanks a lot.
We're going to go right to Daniel. Okay. We lost Daniel. I wanted to let you talk a little bit about your website.
Oh, yeah, the website.
Because people know the show. They know the Encounters show, but they might not know there's a whole website behind it.
I'm all cranked up about this website thing. It's www.encountersnorth.org. Encounters North, one word. And we've had this website for quite a while. Most of the Encounters programs, for those of you who want to listen to old programs, most of them are there, and we're working to get all of those programs available that way on the website. And I'll say again, we're going to link that with KSKA's website here, so it'll be easy for you to get to it. What I love about the website right now is we have a grant from the Educational Foundation of America to develop this website, especially for teachers, mostly at the high school and perhaps university level, natural history. So there will be texts on various topics. We got a long ways to go with this, but we've got five new topics up there. We've got a vision. and we're really rolling on it. We're going to have 10 new topics up by the end of this month. It is written text about the natural history of these various things like beaver and caribou and stuff like that. We have photographs. I've been madly taking pictures over the last number of years while I'm out there. We have natural sounds. And we're making little videos where I'm doing like little mini encounters things, you know, 4 or 5 minutes long on various topics that we're having a lot of fun doing. Liz McKenzie is writing this down in Sitka. She's on the faculty at the university there in creative writing. So we're working on this website, and I want to keep developing it. My big enthusiasm is to do anything possible to bring the natural world of Alaska to especially young people and to older people. Like, I think a lot about AARP members because they're my people.
Your tribe.
Know, there are a lot of people of retirement age who really want to learn about the natural world. And I'm thinking about those people as well as the young ones in working on this website. So we're having a great time with it. And we're really, really soaking up all kinds of ideas. We want to make this into a really good website for anybody interested in the natural world in Alaska. And it'll be something different.
Well, that's great. I've visited it. It's rich already, and
oh,
I guess
good.
It's going to get richer. You can find it on alaskapublic.org. So anyway, you're listening to Richard Nelson, the voice, the mind, the creativity behind Encounters. But as he's quick to tell you, he's not the only person that works on that. We'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. This is Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website, alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA FM 91.1.
Welcome back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. We have Richard Nelson with us today of the Encounters radio program, Adventures from the North. We've been talking about all kinds of things, like how does he do it? You know, what's he going to do next? What's the website like? We have a few more minutes for callers to call in and ask their questions. We've had some great questions.
Yeah,
this
we
afternoon.
Sure have. They've been fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. Things that have really pushed and pulled the way we think. So if you've got a question, don't hold back. We're at 550-8433. Or 1-888-353-5752, or send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we're going to go to an email that we got at the top of the show, and it's a bit of something to chew on. This happens to be a graduate student from UAF who's turning in a paper today and has a question for you.
Wow.
So I hope you have the answer for him. He seems to know a lot about your work. So I'm going to go ahead and read from it because it's kind of complicated, but let's go ahead and do it.
Okay.
First, with your misgivings about using quantifiable measurements to determine the importance of subsistence lifestyles to those who participate, how do you feel about recent endeavors to place economic valuations on ecosystem services?
Okay, that's a very intelligent and challenging question. Let me start by explaining that there has been off and on over the years an effort to say that subsistence, that is the way that people in rural Alaska live from the land, from moose and caribou and fish and all the rest of it, that subsistence, the importance of it can be measured in monetary terms. So if we say moose meat is worth X dollars per pound or whatever, then we can come up with a monetary measure of the importance of subsistence. I've been really skeptical about that. I mean, I think it's fine, but what it misses is that subsistence is so much more than just pounds of meat or plants or whatever. That subsistence is something that is riven right through to the center of people's souls. And so my analogy has always been, if you're going to place an economic value on subsistence, tell me in economic terms how much Christmas is worth. And let's walk up to people's doors and say, we're here, we've got a check for $554, and we're going to give you that in exchange for not celebrating Christmas this year, or Thanksgiving, or Hanukkah. Take your pick. So I think that kind of measure has the monetary measures have value, but they miss maybe the biggest value of all, and that's culture and lifestyle, what people value, how it binds a community and a family together, and that sort of stuff. So there are also efforts to measure the importance of ecosystems in monetary terms. And, you know, I think that's okay in the sense that if that's what it takes to help people from certain, you know, non-environmental backgrounds to understand that this ecosystem that's providing us with water and electricity and heat and food and whatever, that this which I'm just glossing over, but anyway, you get my idea, that it's worth this many dollars per year. I think that has value if it helps people to understand, if it helps them to some kind of understanding. But I'd come back to the same analogy, because to me, to go out into a full ecosystem, full functioning ecosystem with all of its parts there, if somebody said, I'll give you $400 to never go out there, I'd have a lot of ideas what they could do with their $400, yeah. But spending it on me wouldn't, you know, I just think it misses another value, that this is our world, this is our earth, this is our habitat, this is the place that fills up our senses, this is the place that brings us joy and beauty, this is the place that really not only makes us be alive, this is the place that makes it worth being alive. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to measure fully. in monetary terms. And if we say that if we would ever imply that the full value of an ecosystem can be measured in monetary terms, we would be so drastically undervaluing ecosystem services that it makes our world a much smaller thing than it mm-hmm. really is. You got to have it all. As I say, the economic valuations are fine, but
they're not holistic.
But be very careful. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We're going to have one little follow-up question from this UAF grad student.
Okay, it's a great question.
When interviewed by Project Jukebox, you said you were uncertain if your work actually accomplished what you had set out to accomplish. Has enough time passed to allow you to see the fruits of your labor?
Oh, boy, that's a nice one. Thanks for that question, too. Over time, you know, I guess it's like anything else as time passes. I look at the photographs that I took when I lived in the village of Wainwright on the North Slope in 1961, 62, 63, 64, back in there. And those are now historic photographs. So much of the way of life has changed. It's not gone. You know, people still are out there doing subsistence. It still means everything to them. But the way they did it back then was very different. And so those photographs, that they were just pictures back then, they have a much bigger value now. Similarly, for the traditions that I have been privileged to write about from the teachings of other people in indigenous communities, those writings that people gave to me have become increasingly valuable. So it's my work as a writer, as an anthropologist, is all about just passing along gifts. And those gifts intrinsically have become more valuable over time.
So you would say yes.
I would say, yeah, that was a long way of saying yes.
Yeah, emphatically, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to go to a caller.
Great.
Tricia, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for doing what you do, Richard Nelson. It's greatly appreciated. I am a homeschool mom who uses your shows with both of my girls.
Oh, that's great, Tricia. Wow, thank you.
And I also wanted to ask, did your thrushes come back this summer?
Oh, what a sweet question. I did have a thrush come back to my yard this year. Every year, you know, it just measures the spring for me in the early part of summer. And the thrushes skipped a year, and it was a real heartache for me. And I had actually two thrushes around my yard this summer, and I was out there at 3 o'clock in the morning recording them with a big smile on my face because it was such a joy to have that back. And in 27 years that I've lived in the same house, that one year was the only time I haven't had thrushes there. So, that's a very sweet question. Does that mean you have thrushes coming to your yard?
Yes, I had both hermits and swainsons this summer.
Oh, how lucky is that?
It was wonderful. I've heard swainsons in my neighborhood before, but I've never had one nest in my yard before.
Do you have any idea why they didn't come back that one year to your yard?
Oh, I think, it seems that the numbers of them go up and down. Now, I should say that these birds, these wonderful birds like the Swainson's thrush and the hermit thrushes, which are two of our most beautiful singers here in Alaska, they're birds that migrate a long ways. The hermit thrush migrates to the southern U.S. and maybe northern parts of Mexico and stuff like that for the winter. The Swainson's thrush go thrushes that are singing in your backyard go all the way to the Amazon. So they have a prodigious migration. The migration itself is increasingly dangerous because of cell phone towers, because of towers. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that while we're on the radio. But anyway, towers hitting the wires and stuff like that because of tall buildings and the lights and the disorienting effects of those. But lots of other things, losing their winter habitats in the south. So their populations are declining. And that's why I worry so much when there seem to be less of them around. But so I think that that one year that I didn't have them was just happenstance. Mm-hmm. My neighbor had them. My neighbor got them that year. So it's important to share.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Tricia. We're going to go on to a question from Maria. You're on Hometown Alaska?
Yes. Yes, I am. Richard.
Hi.
just love your shows.
Oh, thank you, Maria.
My kids were born in here, my grandkids, and they have moved to California. But I would love to get some CDs or something that I can bring to them. That will be the most precious gift that I can give them. And how can I acquire some CDs so that I can bring them as gift?
Well, I'm sorry, Marie. Go ahead. Did you finish?
Yes, I did. I don't have a computer right now.
Okay, thank you. Well, we've had these sets of CDs, and our supply has run out of those CDs. And so we're working. Now, sometimes you can find them at bookstores. Maybe you might try the Alaska. It used to be called the Alaska Natural History Association. I don't know if they've changed their national parks sometimes have them. If you look around, you might find them. And I'm really sorry that I can't just say, oh, just send a letter or whatever, an order.
I send you the check.
Yeah, right. Well, we're going to make a new set of these CDs of programs, but we haven't got those started yet.
Oh,
I'm very sorry.
Well, that's
to
good
say.
News because
they're 10 and 12 right now, but they do go to bed listening to. At night, that's why they listen to radio books, and they're too busy in the day to do anything else. So.
Oh my gosh, that makes me feel so happy to hear that. And did you hear us mentioning that you can get them from the internet? A lot of them are available for podcast, and I don't know how to do podcasts myself, so that's why I'm saying if you know how to do that.
I'm sure they would too, but still, I just wanted to get the CD, put it in the little CD player.
Yeah, right. I know exactly what you mean.
Well, the good news is that you might have some in the future.
Well, yeah, absolutely. We're committed to producing another set of those.
It just will be so wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
I myself will enjoy just listening over and over.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Maria. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Maria.
Thank you, Rita, for everything you do, and you are just leaving a treasure of knowledge.
Oh, thank you so much.
Generation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
Thank you very much.
We may be able to squeeze in one or two more questions, short ones. So
okay.
I'm going to go ahead and throw the number for folks, 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. I wanted to ask you, we had a call come in an email come in that asked, if you could go back thousands of years, what are the animals that you would wish to record? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do. You know, that is something that I have thought about. Quite a lot, actually, and because I'm an Alaskan, it would be an Alaskan animal, but one that's not here anymore. Probably the thing that would be most magical would be the mammoth or mastodon. Just to think that there were elephants, big hairy elephants, that were wandering around this place where we live now, and not all that long ago. Would be pretty amazing to be able to record whatever sounds they made, presumably big trumpets and the sounds of their feet rustling through the grass and their trunks plucking vegetation or whatever and the chewing sounds and maybe the young ones nursing or something. Oh man, that would be really amazing. There are two animals and only two that are known to have lived in Alaska in historic times and have probably pretty much, it's pretty certain they've disappeared, the spectacled eider out in the Aleutian chain and the stellar sea cow out there too. Two great animals that were hunted very quickly to extinction by the Russians. Now that would be another thing that would be pretty incredible, those animals that are almost within our reach. And the kind of animals that we should think about, we live in a state, it's such a privilege that other than those two species, everything that has ever been known to live here is still here. And we should really think about that and appreciate it and take good care to make sure that there will be no more losses like those two that were lost a couple centuries ago.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Some people think they might still be around, but
hiding out somewhere.
Yeah, way out there in the chain somewhere.
Yeah. Wow. That's well. Are you going to go looking?
Yeah, I'd love to. Oh, that'd be a great excuse to go out to the end of the Aleutians and to the Commander Islands that are part of Russia. The Spectaculider it's gone. It was a flightless. Did I say that? Spectacle Cormorant. My goodness, a little bit of a brain freeze there. Sorry about this. Spectacled Cormorant. The Stellar Sea Cow is the one people imagine might still be around. A great big overgrown manatee. Mm-hmm. But nobody's seen one in a century or two, so I don't think so.
It might be a long search, huh?
Yeah, it might be.
Well, also, you know, you've been doing Encounters since 2004. You've done so much. What are you, aching to do next? What does the new year look like for you?
Oh, yeah. The exciting thing is in the spring, if all goes well, I would like to be on the sea ice up near Barrow and record some programs about the sea ice itself and about the ice seals, the ring seal and the bearded seal. And if I can work it out with the whalers, something about bowhead whales and whaling. Those will be a kind of a dream for me because they go back to my, so many years that I had this amazing chance to learn about sea ice from the Inupiaq people up there in the village of Wainwright. So that's on tap, and I'll be going around closer to home in southeastern Alaska to record programs about probably harbor seals and then seabirds on a seabird colony near Sitka, St. Lazaria Island. And then I'm going to Australia in February for a few months for a couple of months anyway. And I'm hoping my dream would be to record a program about the saltwater crocodile. That's one. I've always been fascinated with reptiles. And the saltwater crocodile is this remarkable creature that's the largest reptile in the world. And that would be really cool to do that.
Wow. You have a big agenda.
Way too big, really. Those are only the immediate ideas.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I'm glad that you haven't come to the end of your passion or your curiosity. There's no way that you have.
No, that's only going to end when I do. Yeah.
Well, folks, we've had some fabulous questions today.
Really, we have. Thank you.
Really, and a great audience. And Richard Nelson, it's been a privilege to have you. People have referred to you as a treasure, and I would say you are. Thank you for advocating for these animals by sharing them with us. It's just really been a treat to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's just fabulous to be here. I always love coming to Anchorage, and the other thing I'd say is I'm a big fan of public radio. I love public radio. So thanks to all of you out there who listen to public radio and help to support it.
Well, we've had a great time today speaking with anthropologist, writer, and Encounters host Richard Nelson. Thank you, Richard, for all your insights and stories today. And thank you to all our callers again who had so many good questions for you. Coming up next on Hometown Alaska, host Peter Dunlap-Scholl will be talking with Chugiak large animal vet Julie Gross. Please connect with us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Visit our website. You'll find Richard's website there. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.